He's 89RN's son. I'm walking over to the station as we talk, and we'll see if we can get him to talk to you.
All right, that sounds real good.
What's your name?
Karen.
Karen? Yeah, did you hear the boy talking?
Yeah, is it Colin?
Colin.
Okay.
Good. All right.
Yes, yeah, so Colin is six. He's six. He's got a Spider-Man knapsack on, rigged for outdoor activity. His dad's now striding across the field with him, and we've had a big day here in the Glen Ellen.
Hey, how you doing? This is Mark, WGAY. Okay, our club is, we're not a very big club. We've got about 35 members continually. And as you heard, our youngest oldest is 9 to 90, and they were both here in attendance today.
You are. This is KWFL.
Okay, very good. And you are in Jefferson, Ohio.
That is correct. Ashtabula County, northeast part of the state of Ohio.
Yes, I can. This is Jeff Hammer in Iraq.
Well, Jeff, you're calling from Iraq. How is field day going there for you?
It's actually going amazingly well. We've talked to a number of stations across Europe, still trying to get that connection back with the U.S., though.
What call sign are you using there, sir?
Yankee India Niner, November India Charlie.
Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. This week, our special guest is Richard Moseson. He's the editor for CQ Magazine. And we'll have Richard coming up very shortly right here on QSO, brought to you by the TW Antenna Company, Heil Sound, and Gigaparts.
Wireless. You hear that word used a lot today. We have wireless telephones, wireless internet systems, wireless microphones. What it actually means is that they are radios. And who knows more about radios than amateur radio operators? Call them amateurs or call them hams. They know the modern wireless world. They helped create it.
We want to invite you to check out the website at www.tedrandall.com. That's www.tedrandall.com. All the programs and shows that you hear right here on QSO are available on the website for download as podcasts. We invite you to check them out and browse the site and find out interesting things at www.tedrandall.com. Our guest is Richard Moseson. He's the editor of CQ Magazine. And, I'll ask the question, how far back does CQ go?
CQ goes back to 1945. First issue is January that year, and we've had a new one every month ever since.
Boy, some interesting reading. I bet the archives are just full of things you could get lost in.
Oh, absolutely. I was just looking at one today from 1962 that had reports on the first Oscar satellite launch. You can just get lost for hours.
You know, that's a... It's an amazing thing. An amateur radio magazine has got to be so many things to so many people. And, of course, we know there used to be the magazine 73 that Wayne Green put together. And of course, but it seems now, you know, and let's play a little chronology here. Wasn't CQ around prior to 73, though?
Yes, 73 started in 1960. Or 61, somewhere in there.
That's what I thought, and it seemed like then 73 started up after CQ was there.
In fact, Wayne Green was the editor of CQ from 1955 to 1960.
I knew he was connected somewhere. Then I think when he left, he started 73.
He left and started 73 on his own, right?
And then after 73 since went by the wayside, mm-hmm. And that magazine is missed. But now, as far as the magazine is concerned, CQ is like a whole different realm of ham radio. I mean, now this is the way I think about it. Now, you're the editor, so you can tell me if I'm right. To me, the CQ covers a whole different realm. It's a whole different approach to amateur radio than the ARRL's counterpart, QST.
Yes, in a certain sense. QST's primary goal is to be a membership journal of the league and to report on what the ARRL is doing, and that's its primary mission. Our primary mission is to be a fun magazine about all the fun things that go on ham radio. And our focus has always been more toward the operating side of things. It doesn't mean that we don't do technical articles. We certainly do a fair number of them. But our focus has always been on practical applications and the operating side of things. For example, in our equipment reviews, we're less interested in lab results than in how does it work? How do you sound on the air? How easy is it to use? It's just a difference in perspective and approach.
Well, you know, I guess I'm going to say with the advent of so many new hams coming on board. Now people say, where are all these new hams? Well, they're there, believe me. There's a lot of new ones coming on board because of the no-code license now. There's a lot of shortwave listeners that I hear from that are contemplating getting into ham radio. And if you haven't looked at CQ Magazine, let's just take a brief tour, I guess I want to say, of the magazine. You're the editor. Tell us a little bit about, if I go out and I purchase one on the newsstand, what am I going to find between cover to cover?
Well, you're going to find different things in different months. We do have a fair amount of focus on the contest that we sponsor, and we sponsor the most popular contests in the world, the CQ Worldwide DX contest and the CQ WPX contest. But a wide variety of feature articles on different aspects of ham radio, from stories of de-expeditions to stories of people getting their start in the hobby, and all sorts of different things about what people do in project articles. And we try to be as broad as possible in our features. Among our columns, we have certain ones that are there every month and every 2 months or every 3 months, depending on what it is. But CQ is the only ham magazine with not only one but two regular columns that are focused on the newcomer to ham radio. Every month we have our Beginner's Corner column that's put together by Wayne Yoshida, KH6WZ. And every other month we have a How It Works column by Dave Ingram, K4TWJ. And the purpose of that column is essentially to take a look at the stuff you needed to learn to pass your test, or let me rephrase that, the stuff you needed to memorize to pass your test, and explain it so that you actually now learn about it and then begin to understand it and what it's about. And that's the basic concept behind that column. Plus, we have regular columns on mobiling, on public service, on projects, again, contest, DXing, awards, propagation. You name it. If it has something to do with ham radio, it shows up in CQ at some point.
Well, you know, you're talking about propagation now. You know, with a print publication, you have to really kind of be ahead of the game, because when you're talking about propagation, of course, you can forecast, but reporting on a regular basis as to what the atmosphere and the sun is doing and how the frequencies are reacting and all that kind of thing. I know hams in the past, people that I had dealt with, almost lived by this. In other words, they couldn't wait for the next magazine to come out because they had to find out what the propagation news was. So how do you put all that together? Where does all that information come from?
Well, the short answer is it comes from our propagation editor.
Okay.
But he's got, you know, quite a job. We had, for 50 years, one propagation editor, George Jacobs, W3ASK, who basically more or less invented the art of propagation forecasting and translating it into terms that an average person could understand. So he laid a tremendous foundation. And our current propagation editor, Thomas Hood, NW7US, is doing an excellent job as his successor. You know, because it's a print publication and because there are so many other more immediate avenues available for getting propagation information, the actual forecasts and then reports on conditions take on a little less of a priority than they used to. You know, you go back just 10, 15 years, and you were still in the situation you were talking about, where you can't wait to get the next issue of the magazine to take a look and see what's been happening and what's likely to happen. The forecasting part is still something worth looking for. But as far as day-to-day events on the sun and solar weather and things like that that affect propagation, there are websites that can give you instantaneous information, and we have references to them. What Thomas has done in response to the changes in the world of the Internet, etc., he's started to have a lot more focus in his columns on tutorials of what these different things are about and the art and science of propagation forecasting, how to use the tools that are out there on the Internet, plus, of course, the actual forecasts, which still take, you know, a good deal of crystal ball reading, and you have to really understand rather deeply all of the stuff that's out there that helps you with forecasting. And, you know, technology has certainly improved the capability. For example, we have satellites now that more in some way actually see the backside of the sun and can let you know what's developing behind the sun. I have no idea how that works, but it does. And we know that the sun basically rotates on a 27-day period, so that if there were a big clump of sunspots today, then 27 days from now, those sunspots, if they're still there, will come back around. But, you know, there are ways now of actually looking to the backside of the sun and seeing what's happening. So the technology and the satellites that are out there, the SOHO Observatory and things like that, just give us tremendous added information about what's and understanding about what's going on the sun, that it makes it a little easier, if you really understand it all, to make those forecasts. But there's a very steep and deep learning curve, which is why you have somebody like Thomas to be your columnist, because he actually understands it, and his job is to try to explain it to the rest of us.
That's and that's amazing. And I was not aware, you know, in the shortwave radio realm, George Jacobs has been a world-renowned consulting engineer to shortwave stations all over the globe. And he has just an incredible reputation in that area. So, but I was unaware that he was the forecaster, you know, going back years for propagation. That makes perfect sense. What a better person to have filled that position back when there was no internet. I was going to ask you contests. I mean, the CQ contests are just absolutely so popular. I mean, they're over the edge with most hams. Tell us a little bit about the contest, especially for folks who are new to the ham radio arena. How do they get their feet wet in this arena, and what would you suggest they start with, and how do they find out about all this, and how do you digest all the data that's in the magazine?
Well, contesting can be one of the most, terrible grammar, but most fun things you can do in ham radio.
We don't worry about grammar here on this radio show, so don't even think about
well,
that.
Well, I'm an editor, so I worry about it. But it can be a tremendous amount of fun. You're out there just making very brief contacts with people everywhere, and the bands are full of activity, and Contests are great for building up your country count. If you're looking to make contacts with more countries, well, those countries are going to be on the air during the contests. And it's said that our contests make their own propagation, that a band can be completely dead before and after the contest, but it's full of activity during the contest from all over the place. There may be something to that. It could be that all the RF going into the air actually does create some heating in the ionosphere. More likely, though, it's the fact that there are small openings all the time. Even, 10-meter band today, bottom of the sunspot cycle, is supposed to be dead. Truth is, it's not. There are openings all the time, it's just nobody knows about them, and nobody gets on the band now because it's supposed to be dead. So they don't waste their time there, and as a result, they miss a lot. But, a ham radio contact can only work if there's a station at both ends of the path. So when there's an opening and there's nobody at one end or the other of the path of the opening, then there's no contact to be made. But when you get into the contest and there's people on everywhere, they become aware of and take advantage of the openings that are already there.
I want to talk about that a little bit more in depth in just a little bit. Our guest is Richard Moseson. He is the editor of CQ Magazine.
Do you suffer from the heartbreak of brain rot, feeling bored, sluggish, listless, not had a new idea in days, using electronic gizmos without a clue why they work? Now there's help. Ham radio, guaranteed to stimulate your corroding neurons and open a whole new world of excitement. To learn more about ham radio, go to helloradio.org.
Side effects of ham radio usage include mental stimulation, desire for education, new career paths, understanding of technology, and cases of addiction have been reported. If you experience any of these symptoms, you're welcome.
Ham radio, it's not your granddaddy's radio anymore.
And now here's Dave Sparks, N4OZO, for the TW Antenna Company.
Good to be on the show here, Ted. One of the things that I noticed right off is it's an antenna that can be set up extremely quickly. It can be set up in less than 5 minutes, which just makes it great for taking on portable de-expeditions or even for campers that need a portable antenna to set up, emergency situations, field day. There's just endless uses for an antenna that can be set up as quickly as the 2010.
When you first saw the antenna, be honest, what did you think the first time you saw it?
I'll be honest with you, I was a little bit hesitant when I first saw the antenna. Of course, at that time, I hadn't tried one, and I think a lot of times, all of us hams are a little bit sort of hold-offish until we actually get a chance to try something. We tend to not suspect or very much out of a product like that. The antenna for its size, which it's not real tall, it's only about 6'10" tall, the actual antenna. You just look at something like that, and you don't really expect a lot. And that's where I was wrong.
So when you hooked it up and you started using it, what was the first thing that surprised you?
The first thing that surprised me is if I could hear them, I could work them. And it didn't matter where in the world they were. And that just, it brought an immediate smile to my face.
So where are some of the places that you have talked to, some of the places you've worked with this antenna?
I have worked, besides just numerous stations around the country, I've worked a lot of stations over in Europe, Asia, Africa, and one of my favorite things to do, Ted, is I like to work islands. And so I have really concentrated on working a lot of islands with it, and I've really done well. I recently worked the Ducie Island de-expedition on both 20 and 17 meters, and got them like on each band in the first or second or third try, and I was just really surprised.
How does the thing do stateside? We know it's a good DX antenna. I've heard this really low takeoff, 26 degree takeoff angle that it has.
Right, right.
But how does it do stateside? Is it going to do some rag chewing on?
Well, it does really well. The people that I've talked to, even around the states, Ted, when I tell them what type of antenna that I'm using, and oftentimes you you get asked this, especially if you're putting in a pretty good signal to the other party that you're talking to. And I describe the antenna to them, and you can tell at first they're puzzled. And then they'll go to the website and look the antenna up. Sometimes when I'm on the air with them, they'll do that. And, of course, they're surprised. And what really surprises them is not only are they looking at it and seeing what it is on the website, but they're hearing me talk on it at the same time. So they get a chance to really see what the performance of the antenna is while they're looking at it.
Okay, well, we're gonna tell everybody, be listening for Dave Sparks, N4OZO. He's going to be with us every week. He's going to tell us who he's talked to on the TW2010. And for all of you folks that succeed in working Dave, finding him on the radio dial and making a communication with him, you're going to get the QSL card from the QSO radio show here and an I Worked Dave certificate, which...
That sounds great.
We're going to have a lot of fun with this.
I'm going to look forward to this.
Thank you much for joining me here. And we're going to hear from you every week now. And you're going to tell us all about your activities on the TW2010 and then the up-and-coming TW8020.
Yes, that is in the design works right now.
Our guest is Richard Moseson. He is the CQ editor of CQ Magazine, the amateur radio magazine that's all about ham radio. You were talking about being an editor. We were talking about grammar. Now, when you get an email from somebody like me, do you ever look at this and go, "Oh my God, where did this guy learn punctuation?" Do you find yourself in that position?
I don't worry about it in emails. I worry about it in articles.
The reason why I say is I'm the world's worst when it comes to punctuation. I just wonder, you were always, as a kid, I was always so self-conscious when I would write something. I have to write something that had to go to an English teacher. It's like, So don't. So if you want to write Richard an email, don't worry. He's not going to look at the punctuation. But you were worried about grammar earlier. We were talking about contesting. You're talking about, this is so interesting. And this is something I've believed for so long, because as a younger person, I would sometimes just out of the clear blue, when the band is dead and supposedly inactive, I just jump on and start calling CQ. And I was always so amazed at how many times I had somebody come back to me that was just as amazed as I was that we were making contact on this dead band. Tell me a little bit more about this, because I believe there's something to this.
To me, propagation is one of the most fascinating parts of the radio hobby. Whether you're a ham or a shortwave listener, the art of finding the openings. And one of the greatest things about it is that we don't know all that much about it. And that means that there's still opportunities for us as users of the radio spectrum to learn, to discover, and to contribute to the body of knowledge, the scientific knowledge, about propagation. We're in an extended lull in the sunspot cycle. Yet, in June, the 6-meter band was open transoceanic. You could talk from the East Coast to Europe, from the West Coast to Japan. It's not supposed to happen at the bottom of the sunspot cycle. That's only supposed to happen at the peak of a sunspot cycle. But it's happening anyway. And now we have the opportunity to try to look at these contacts and figure out why and how. And by providing data on the contacts that are made, we can help the scientists, both professional and amateur, dig deeper and try to figure out and learn more about the ionosphere and radio wave propagation. And it's an area that we as amateurs can still contribute to. And it makes it so much, such a wonderful thing. Back on contests, you're asking about getting your feet wet. I would not try to get my feet wet in the CQ Worldwide DX contest, because that is where all the big guns are out, and they've got their multi-operator, multi-transmitter, multi-antenna stations running with as much power as they're allowed to in whatever country they're in. they're knocking off the contacts at lightning speed. So it's a bit intimidating for a new contester or a new ham to try to get into the deep end of the pool, so to speak, particularly if you're interested in CW contesting, Morse code. In fact, in our September issue, our contesting editor, John Doerr, K1AR, and I are having a conversation in print about slow-speed CW and its place in contesting. Because, you know, a long time ago there was a contest called Novice Roundup, which ran for 2 weeks, and it let people who were new to ham radio have an opportunity to learn about operating in a competitive environment without the pressure of it being a 48-hour event with all these monster signals on. And that has kind of gone away. Well, it's completely gone away. You know, what do you do if you're interested in CW contesting and want to get started, but you're not sending and receiving at 30 to 40 words a minute, which is the typical speeds during the big-time CW contests? And that's a topic of a discussion that goes back and forth in John's column in September. But in general, for starting out in contesting, my suggestions would be to start with some of the smaller contests. There are state QSO parties, which basically your goal is to contact as many different counties in a given state as possible. And if you're in the state, the idea is to get as many different counties on the air as possible. And these tend to be smaller, lower pressure events, more fun, more relaxed, and it helps you get acclimated to the ideas and methods of contesting and of operating competitively. There are also some other small contests. So some of the European countries have their own contests that are similar to the state QSO parties. An advantage to the state QSO parties, of course, is that it can help you toward different awards. The Worked All States Award that the AWR and our USA Counties Award for working up to, well, there are 3,077 counties in the United States, and working all of them is quite an achievement. We've had over 1,000 people who have done that. But I think the first level of that award is at 500. And if you operate a bunch of state QSO parties, you're going to find your county count climbing pretty quickly if you're interested in earning awards. So that would be my suggestion for getting your feet wet in contesting, is to go with the state QSO parties or some of the VHF contests, which are a tremendous amount of fun as well. And you do find these band openings on 6 meters and 2 meters where you can work quite a far distance.
You know, as the editor of the magazine, of course, you're exposed to all the different modes of operation with ham radio. And, you know, as time has gone on, we have seen a lot of advancement in these modes. There are all sorts of different kind of things going on. What do you see as the new emerging technologies? Because if anyone's exposed to all of this and you have a feel for the interest nationwide amongst amateurs, you're the person that's going to view this from a bird's eye view. What do you see on the horizon? What's coming up?
Well, I think the big thing is going to be digital voice. And you're seeing development in that area now in D-Star, which is becoming quite popular on VHF and UHF. And moving a little less slowly are some of the digital voice modes on the HF bands. There's one system that is used by AOR with its add-on boxes, and that's got a good number of adherents. There are a couple of other sound card modes like WinDRM, FDMDV, I think I've got those initials right, that are also digital voice modes that are gaining in popularity. And on the technical side, I'm fascinated with the advent of the software-defined radios, where all of the parameters of the radio are in software, as opposed to the traditional hardware-tuned circuits and things like that. It's all in software. And you can download a whole new radio over the Internet, essentially. In fact, a few months ago, I did a review of the Tentec Omni 7, and you can download new firmware from that. And it was very scary the first time I did it, because when you start the process up after you've downloaded onto your computer the new update, you push the right buttons after you connect the radio to the computer, and the first thing it says is erasing radio. That was scary.
Format.
Fortunately, it wrote a new one to it.
I've heard about this, and I've done a little reading on it, and but it's I mean that's what's happening. I mean, it's going in that direction. You know, I guess one of my pet peeves is to hear people say things like, with all the new technology, computers and whatnot, and the iPods, and that's what's driving or driving young people away from amateur radio. In other words, all this new stuff, they're fascinated by it, and amateur radio is old hat, old stuff. And it's just not the case at all. And I mean, I hear this stuff, and I'm thinking, what are these people thinking? Now, talk to me a minute about the new technology and the use of computers in ham radio. I mean, this is getting very, very integrated, obviously, software-defined radios. How do you see this fitting in? I mean, I think one of our, and I don't want to get off on a tangent here. I think one of our problems as far as young people is concerned, somebody had written into a column that was being read by folks off of the American Radio Relay, and the guy said, it's off their radar. It's just not on their radar right now. And if you get it on their radar, they're very fascinated by it. It's something very, very cool. How do you see the computer changing the face of ham radio as far as young people are concerned?
Well, I agree with the off-the-radar comment. I had read that also. And that's been my experience. Kids today don't know ham radio exists unless you introduce it to them. And when you do, they are captivated by it. And that's, you know, I've been trying to introduce ham radio to young people for years, ever since I was one. They're still totally captivated by it. My daughter is 18, and she has a relatively new boyfriend who wanted to see my radios the other day. And we were down here trying them out, and of course all the bands were dead, but we were talking about stuff. And you know, he wanted to know, what's the farthest you've ever contacted? And I said, well, it'll probably have to be like New Zealand, because you can't go farther than that without starting to come back again. Mm-hmm. But we went looking for a QSL card, because he followed that with, well, what's the most remote place you've ever contacted? And I said, well, Antarctica and Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. It's a little dot of land with a British and American air bases on it. And I went looking through the QSL cards to try to find the cards from there. And he's watching and looking at them and going. And finally he says, wow. And I thought Pokemon cards were cool.
Oh,
so, you know, young people really do get captivated by ham radio when you expose it to them. Well, you know, when I was a kid, if you were interested in electronics and electronic communication, ham radio was about the only choice out there. Now there are many other choices, so you don't, with a lot, much bigger advertising budgets, so you don't automatically come to ham radio. Somebody has to show it to you. Somebody has to tell you about it. As far as computers go, I think computers and ham radio are wonderful partners. You know, it's not only the computer running the software for running the radio, but, you know, I just recently got a couple of new VHF rigs for my car, and I had gotten one several months ago, and then we got a new car a few months later, and this is one of those radios with the detachable head, and I had it installed so nicely and comfortably in there that I didn't want to have to haul it out from under the seat and everything to move it from one car to the other. So I bit the bullet and said, I'm just going to buy a second one and put it in the other car. And along with it, I bought some what I thought was cloning software. But it turned out to be more. It's frequency management software. And it not only communicates with the radio, but it communicates with a program that the ARRL puts out called Travel Plus for Repeaters, which is their repeater directory integrated with a mapping program. And you bring that up on your computer, you're making a trip, you chart out your route on the map on the screen, and then it generates a list of repeaters along that route.
Oh, my goodness.
You can then take that list and export it to the frequency management software, which puts it into the database for the radio. You plug in the radio, you push clone, and it transfers all the memory, all the repeater information into your radio's memories.
That's incredible.
It's incredible. I had to make a trip up to Rochester, New York a few weeks ago, and I sat down and charted out the route, made the list, brought the radio in, plugged it in, and about a minute and a half later, I had all the repeaters from New Jersey to Rochester programmed into the radio. And I didn't have to sit there punching up numbers. And so, you know, the computer is becoming more and more of an integral part of any ham shack. Not to mention computer logging and online confirmations through the league's Logbook of the World program. They basically have become inseparable, but they do not drive people away. We have had a series of interviews over the last several months with some very senior leaders in the military and in other government positions who happen to be hams. Maybe happen to be is the wrong word, because part of what they were talking about is the importance that ham radio has played in their careers and in advancing their careers. And one of the universal things that they have talked about is the opportunity that ham radio presents today to get your hands into how electronics works. Computers, iPods, cell phones, they are commodities. They're tools. Nobody goes in and plays with the inside of their iPod to see what else they can make it do. First of all, it's glued shut, and you can't open it. you can't even change the battery. And nobody goes into their cell phone and decides to try to tweak this or play with that, because it's just not done. And besides, it's too dang expensive. Ham radio is still the primary place that people who want to find out how things work, play with things, do things themselves, rather than playing with toys that other people have designed and built for them to try to design and build their own things. Ham radio is still the only place where you can do that. You can go into your radios, you can tweak this, turn that, add this, add on this circuit, change the software, and there's no other real opportunity to do that in the consumer electronics world. And that is what continues to make ham radio different, is the hands-on experience in electronics that it can provide you.
Richard Moseson is our guest. He is the editor of CQ Magazine. You might want to know, why is it that we talk about Heil microphones so much, or why do I need a Heil microphone? Here's Bob Heil talking about Heil microphones. Let's talk microphones for a second. When you're in a situation like emergency or disaster field day and you really want to punch through and you want something that's going to just cut through the mustard, so to speak, what's a good microphone to do that?
Well, we're talking about amateur radio, and, of course, the FCC dictates the fact that we'll be about 3 KCs wide, so you don't have a lot of bandwidth. Well, what we do is the microphone for that choice is a microphone that we tailor with an it actually has a labyrinth inside it, Ted. It's an amazing little piece that I designed back in 1982. And this thing tunes 10 dB spike at about 2,500 cycles. I mean, it's just in your face. Not pretty sounding, but it cuts right through, rolls everything off under 600 cycles, everything off of it about 5K, with this great big spike right in the middle of the human voice, where we need to know, what did you say, an F or an S, a P or a B, to get that articulation. Because when we're out in the emergencies, or with we're just running a contest with a lot of noise and there's a lot of stations, that guy's going to be heard first because all of his power is going to be right where the human ear wants to hear those important syllables. And that's what we've done for this industry, is create microphones that do that. We also have, of course, as you well know, microphones that work on the performance level. But for ham radio, it's a whole different ballgame because we're only dealing with 2.5 to 3 KC wide bandwidth that the FCC will dictate to us. But the important thing is to get articulation through, and then we build that in microphones that you can hold in your hand, or we build it in headsets that you can wear and have hands-free, that kind of thing.
Well, now, of all the Heil models, which one is the most optimum for that sort of thing? Which one would you, if you were going to pick one today to operate field day, what would you pick?
Well, we build a number of things. That element is called an HC4, a Heil cartridge 4. That's got that big spike in it. And that HC4 we build in a headset, our ProSet 4. We build it in a microphone, which is the HM10 that has both elements in it, both that HC4 and the HC5, which is a real smooth reg-2 type thing. And we have it in our Goldmine, the GM4. And all of those products have the HC4 for ultimate communications. And then they have another element that you can switch in for when you're just talking to your buddies and you don't need all that that spike and that articulate sound to cut through noise and things. But we make the HC4 into a lot of different products because we make various headsets and microphones, and the HC4 is the one to do that with.
Of all the Heil mics, which ones do you find the HC4 cartridge in?
Well, we have the HM10, our Goldmine GM4. Those are both microphones. In fact, the GM4 looks like our PR20 that you see on the stages, but has a push-to-talk switch in it, and it has both of these elements. It has the wideband element and the HC4. Then we also have the Handy Mic. And the Handy Mic 4, it's only 4 inches long. It has this element in it, and that's what we use for a hand mic. It's just wonderful for communications for ham radio.
Before you make your next selection for a microphone for your new ham rig or your old ham rig, remember Heil Sound. That's heilsound.com. Or you can find them on our website at tedrandall, tedrandall.com. And remember, Heil is spelled H-E-I-L. That's H-E-I-L. HeilSound.com. We're with Richard Moseson. He's the editor of CQ Magazine. And for all the readers of CQ and prospective readers, this is turning out to be quite an informative radio session here. We were talking about computers. We were talking about the advent of the computer. This whole thing about the repeater, you know, I can, I'm used to driving around with a repeater directory in my hand saying, well, let me see, what town am I in here? Trying to find a machine that way, it's beyond imagination to think you can just hit the road and the radio is already programmed and you're just going to be able to follow the route all the way through. You run into all of this. You're the editor of this magazine, so you get all these things firsthand and you're able to see it, you know, probably way before the average amateur gets to see it. What are you finding, you know, in terms of, well, let me ask this. Let's go back a ways. Tell me a little bit about your beginnings in amateur radio. How did you get started in it? You know, how long have you been a ham? And
I've been a ham since 1970. And like many hams out there today, I got my start through CB radio and through shortwave listening. My first exposure was in Boy Scouts. My scoutmaster was a very active CB-er. And this was back in the late 60s when CB was still a much more civil radio service. and there were licenses and call signs. My dad and I got involved in that and made a lot of good friends and had a lot of fun with it. But the horizons are somewhat limited. I discovered shortwave listening through the ham radio club in my high school, and which remind me to come back to the topic of young people in ham radio and how many there are today versus how many there were 30, 40 years ago. But I remember the first club meeting I went to. We didn't have a permanent station set up at the time, and one of the kids brought in a shortwave receiver and threw an antenna out the window and turned it on, and the first station we tuned in was Radio Tirana. Now, this was 1968, 69. Albania was the most closed society on the planet. And here I am listening to them. And I was instantly hooked, and still am. And so through shortwave listening, broadcast band listening, CB, the interest in radio was kindled, and I wanted to not only be able to listen around the world, but I wanted to be able to talk back, too. And so I got my ham license and have slowly made my way through every class of license, and it took me 30 years to get the DXCC award, the award for confirmed contacts with 100 different countries. But I finally got there, and I'm a bit of a generalist, and I don't get focused on any one particular area in the hobby, whether it's DXing or contesting or satellites or meteor scatter or whatever. I like to do a little bit of everything, which is why it took me 30 years to get DXCC, because I didn't want to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to try to work Albania or something like that. So I've had a lot of fun with all sorts of different things in ham radio, and there's always something new and different coming along. Anybody who says they're bored with ham radio hasn't looked hard enough for something new and different to try.
Well, I was amazed. I mean, different modes of operation. Then you've been able to see so much of the progress like I have. And I tend to get lost, to be real honest with you. I mean, I tend to get lost. People talk about things in ham radio, and I don't even know what it is. you know, and a lot of folks are real intimidated by it. You know, they're like, well, I don't know what that is, but I'm certainly not going to ask the question because I don't want to reveal how dumb I am. And I know that happens a lot. I know I hear people say that when I'm talking to them. But there's a lot of new stuff that I'm not even familiar with. So I don't understand boredom in ham radio. That doesn't seem like it's like two different words that don't go together. You know, there's just no way. Well, what do you, right, like right now, you say you're a generalist, but there's got to be some things that you do on a regular basis, things that you that have become staple to your ham activities. And what are those?
Nothing really all the time. I try to get on during our contests. I try to get on 6 meters. That's my favorite band because you never know when it's going to pop open for 1,500 or 3,000 miles and then go away again. I enjoy 17 meters, 10 meters when it's open. I like to talk to people on local repeaters when I'm in the car. And local doesn't mean local anymore because there are so many repeaters that are part of linked networks that the range is expanded tremendously. And then if they're also linked into some of the internet linking groups like IRLP or EchoLink, then your reach from your car is expanded worldwide, and you can talk to people in other continents with a 2-meter mobile rig because you're hooked through a network. So I still basically like to do a little bit of everything, and I wish I could get on more than I do, but other than that, I still tinker. I play with the digital mode sometimes, and things like PSK31, and I've been playing with D-Star, which is the digital voice, and do occasional HF digital voice as well. So I wish I had more time for operating, but, you know, work and life get in the way, like with so many other things.
Well, tell us a little bit about the HF digital voice, because a lot of fellas have heard about it. Some people are tempted to play with it. Describe it a little bit to us, what your experience has been with digital voice.
And my primary experience on HF has been with the AOR system, which is a modem that you plug into the mic jack on your radio and the speaker jack. And there are some voice card modes out there like WinDRM and such that work slightly differently. I don't have any first-hand experience with those. When you have a solid contact and solid signal, the audio quality is absolutely amazing. It's like your local FM repeater. It is just clear, clean, no noise, like he's sitting right next to you. The only problem is that you need to have a good, strong signal. Otherwise, it breaks up. And the nature of digital anything is it's either there or it's not. And you get a lot of dropout. And unlike analog noise, where it gets noisy, when a digital noise sounds like, well, what it is the software trying to reconstruct what it can from what's out there, and as a result, you get sounds like that as it's trying to pull syllables out. And so when you don't have a strong signal, and of course, with HF, you're subject to fading and to bursts of noise and things like that that are going to degrade the signal level. It's tough. The technology is not really ready for prime time in the sense of being foolproof 100% of the time. But you got to remember what ham radio is about is experimenting. Or one of the things ham radio is about is experimenting. And if you're operating one of these modes, it's not plug and play. You're on the leading edge of something new and different, and you're part of making it better and pushing the limits and finding out what it can do and what you can make it do and what are the conditions that will work with it, what are the conditions that won't, what can you do to make it better? And that's part of what being a ham is about, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's interesting. You're talking about being on the cutting edge and thinking about doing digital communication, digital voice, I should say, over HF is really a milestone. And as time goes on, of course, this will get developed, it'll get more refined, and we'll look back on the days of what's going on now, much like the early days when single sideband first came into existence. And, of course, the critics then said, well, it sounds like Donald Duck talk, you know, and all of that. And, of course, we all know the history between AM and sideband. What's amazing, though, is I'm finding that, you know, I tune in and I listen to some of these fellows that are operating AM, and I'm hearing younger people that are building up PDM AM transmitters, homebrew, you know, and they're on the air displaying those things. And I find all that so fascinating that we've got so many different modes. Now, you said bring you back to the subject of young people on ham radio. And I'm going to do that. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and I want you to talk a little bit about that subject. Richard Moseson is our guest. He's the editor of CQ Magazine.
I was a lawyer from a big city family, born with a sealed Irish spoon. And I followed my daddy's life. I got me a fancy wife, played that traditional tune. Had a home on Long Island, three kids and a maid, and an office on Park Avenue. Years I'd been pouring my blood, my sweat, and hell for what? I realized just then what my life had become. Decided I had to fly. So I hopped in my caddy, said goodbye to old daddy, headed for some wide open sky. Sally from Syracuse, I was a young recluse. You broke the shell of me. Sally from Syracuse, you're such a silly goose. Don't take your loving from me. Well, she was standing alone at the edge of the turnpike. Her yellow hair was roaming in the breeze, and her smile was charming, and her body quite alarming, as her jeans gave her quite a squeeze. And I pulled up beside her, gave a glance, said, "Inside, dear." And in a minute I knew. She said, "Hey, my name is Sally. Don't dilly-dally. So get this buggy to West Syracuse." Sally from Syracuse, I was a young recluse. You broke the shell over me. Oh, Sally from Syracuse, you're such a silly goose. Don't take your loving from me. We spent the week at her downtown apartment, making it like it was going out of style. Oh, she taught me things that no book ever could, and no court would ever allow. But she loosened me up, gave me a new look on life, and I learned what a dud I've been to. So when you're out there and driving, your mind slipping and sliding, get yourself a Sally for you. From Syracuse, I was a young recluse. You broke the shell over me. Oh, Sally from Syracuse, you're such a silly goose. Don't take your loving from me. When you're out there and driving, your mind's slipping and sliding, get yourself a Sally. She won't dilly-dally. Get yourself a Sally for you. Sally from Syracuse, I was a young recluse. You broke the shell over me. Oh, Sally from Syracuse, you're such a silly goose. Don't take your loving from me.
Something special for you. TW Antennas, your DX adventure, has got a special going on right now. You can now save on shipping when you buy the complete TW 2010 Traveler Antenna Combo. Now, the complete package includes the TW 2010 antenna, the quadruped, and the deluxe transport bag. You have to see this. Go to the website and check this out. It's a complete package, plus $50 savings on shipping. The complete package is $549.85. That's $549.85. But check it out on the website. Go and look at twantennas.com. And if you can't find that, go to our website. And that's tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, for the QSO radio program. And check out the TW Antenna Special right now on QSO.